Welcome back to the deep dive. If you are getting ready to secure your California Qualified Applicator Certificate, specifically for Category Q, that's Maintenance Gardener Pest Control, then you are in exactly the right place. Your mission today is, well, it's pretty laser focused. We're providing the absolute essential knowledge shortcut.
That's right. And this isn't just about passing an exam.
You know,
this is about being safe, being effective, and staying compliant. And let's be honest, the most regulated state for pest management in the entire country.
Absolutely.
And we really want to underscore that this deep dive is a crucial resource provided by Within Range Coaching.
Right.
As an agribusiness consulting firm, our whole mission, our core dedication, is helping small agribusinesses right here in California stay safe and stay compliant. We get the regulatory burden.
It's huge.
It is. So our goal here is to cut through all the complexity of the Department of Pesticide Regulation, the DPR, and get you straight to what actually matters for that exam.
So let's define that person. Who is the Category Q applicant? What does a maintenance gardener actually do?
So the state defines it by their primary tasks. A maintenance gardener is doing cultural tasks first.
Like mowing, pruning.
Exactly. Mowing, pruning, irrigation, just general landscape upkeep. The key word, and you'll hear this a lot, is that the application of pesticides is considered incidental to that main business.
Incidental. Okay. So you're there to maintain the beauty and health of the landscape first, and only secondarily do you deal with pests as they pop up.
Precisely. And that one word, incidental, is really the linchpin for everything we're going to talk about today. It dictates your license limits, the materials you can use, everything.
And our entire framework for this is coming directly from the definitive source, right?
Yes. We're pulling from the comprehensive guide created by the University of California statewide IPM program. It's called Lawn and Residential Landscape Pest Control, a guide for maintenance gardeners.
It's the Bible for this category.
It absolutely is. So we are going to systematically dive deep into those core knowledge areas, six of them.
So what are they?
First, the laws that govern you. Then, the detective work of diagnosis. After that, the strategic playbook of IPM. Then we get into the hazards of the chemicals themselves, followed by critical safety and emergency procedures.
And finally, the tool.
Exactly. The essential mechanics of equipment and calibration. We're calling this whole thing navigating the California compliance minefield.
Okay, minefield sounds about right. So let's unpack that regulatory foundation first. Licensing. What is the single biggest thing you have to know about the difference between a Category Q, the maintenance gardener license, and the much broader Category B landscape maintenance?
Confusing these two is a huge mistake.
And a costly one.
Oh yeah, massive fines. The distinction is all about scope and material restriction. And every maintenance gardener has to internalize this. Category Q is restricted because your pest control work is, again, incidental.
Okay.
The core limitation, the bright red line, is that Category Q applicators are absolutely not allowed to use California restricted materials or any federally restricted use pesticides.
So only the stuff you can, you know, theoretically buy off the shelf.
You must strictly use general use pesticides only, period.
So if a client's job ever needed something stronger, a restricted material, or if your business just grew to the point where pest control was your main service,
you'd be forced to upgrade. You'd have to get that full Category B license.
That's a big deal. But I guess the trade-off is that Category Q has a lower administrative burden.
Exactly right. Because the scope is so much smaller, the continuing education, the CE requirement, is drastically reduced. For Category Q, you only need 8 hours of CE every 2 years to keep your license.
8 hours, okay.
And the state is very specific. A minimum of 2 of those 8 hours have to be dedicated specifically to laws and regulations.
8 hours versus 20 for Category B, that's a big difference.
It is.
But who's responsible for tracking that? Does the DPR send you a reminder?
No, and this is a huge trap for applicators. The DPR does not track your CE hours for you. You, the individual applicator, are personally responsible for keeping all that documentation for a minimum of 3 years.
And I'm guessing it has to be pretty detailed documentation.
Incredibly detailed. You need the instructor's name, the class title, the location, the number of credit hours broken down into laws and other. And the most critical piece for validation is the class's DPR identification code.
The meeting code number.
Yes, the meeting code number. Without that number on your certificate, the course just won't count. It's like you never took it.
That code is the key. Okay, so that's the individual QAC. What about the business itself? It needs a separate license, right? Even for this incidental work.
It does. The first step is the business has to identify its qualified person.
The QAC holder.
Right. The business must have a certified commercial applicator, the QAC holder in Category Q, who is officially named as the person supervising all the pest control work. They carry the liability.
And beyond that person, what does the business have to prove to the DPR?
Three key things. First, proof of financial responsibility. This means chemical liability insurance. It's absolutely essential.
So if a misapplication happens,
if you damage a neighbor's prize-winning roses or something, that liability coverage is your legal and financial safety net. Second, you need workers' compensation insurance if you have any employees. And third, just verification of the business type corporation, sole proprietorship, etc.
That liability piece feels critical for a small business. If an employee makes a mistake, even a supervised one, that causes, say, $10,000 of damage. That insurance is what keeps the business from going under.
Assuming they're compliant, yes. That's exactly what it's for. And the obligations don't stop once you get the license.
Of course not.
The maintenance gardener pest control business license has to be renewed every 2 years. But here's the kicker.
There is always a kicker.
The business also has to annually register in each and every county where they operate.
Wow. So if you work in, say, LA County, Orange County, and Ventura County, that's three separate registrations every single year.
Three registrations plus the main license renewal every other year. And you have to notify the DPR in writing immediately if anything changes. Your address, your qualified person, even a lapse in your insurance. Compliance is a constant state of being in California.
Okay, let's move into the field. The mandatory paperwork, record keeping and reporting. This is the paper trail that proves you're operating by the book.
Right, so maintenance gardener businesses must maintain records of every pesticide they use for a minimum of 2 years.
And those records have to be perfect.
They have to be detailed, accurate, and crucially, ready for inspection by the DPR, or more likely, the County Agricultural Commissioner, the CCI. They are the boots on the ground enforcement for the state.
Let's break down what has to be on that record. This is a big exam topic, I'd imagine. You can't just jot down weed killer.
No, absolutely not. You need the exact date of the application, the name of the property operator, so your client, the physical location address, or a precise description.
And not just the address, right? The specific site.
Exactly. You need the specific site treated. Mm-hmm. So north ornamental bed or fescue turf area by the pool. It has to be that specific.
Mm-hmm.
Then the total units treated, square feet, number of plants, the full identity of the pesticide, which must include the EPA or California registration number.
And the amount.
And the exact amount of pesticide used. Ounces, gallons, whatever. That detail is what proves you followed the label's limits.
And then on top of all that, there are the monthly reports.
A nonstop obligation. Businesses have to submit monthly pesticide use reports to the CAC in the county where the applications happen.
And they're due.
By the 10th of the following month. But here's the classic compliance trap, the one that gets people all the time.
The zero report.
The zero report rule. If you applied absolutely no pesticides in, say, July, you must still submit a report to the CAC by August 10th that says no pesticides applied.
So even if you take a month off for vacation, you still have to file paperwork saying you took a month off.
You do. The state needs to know you were silent, not that you just forgot to report. Failure to file, or filing a false report, can get your business license and your personal QAC suspended or even revoked.
Okay, that's heavy. All right, let's talk about the single most important legal document in your truck. The pesticide label.
The saying is, the label is the law, and it is absolutely literal.
Not a guideline.
Not a guideline. It's a legal document. Violating any instruction on that label is a direct violation of state and federal law. And the full label copy must always be at the use site.
Even if you're using a smaller service container, like a backpack sprayer.
Even then, if you've decanted the product into a properly labeled sprayer, you still need to have the original physical label or a digital copy right there with you, accessible.
And the label dictates the site. You can't use a product labeled for turf use only on a rose bush, even if you know the chemical works.
That's where the liability starts. Yeah. And for the exam, you have to be able to deconstruct that label. Every section has legally binding instructions.
Okay. Let's start with the names, which can be confusing.
Right. The trade brand name is just for marketing. It's not reliable. The essential info is in the ingredients section. It lists the active ingredients, the chemicals that do the killing, and the inert or other ingredients, which are the carriers.
And you have to know the percentage of the active ingredient.
You do, because that's how you calculate your application rate.
Okay. Then we get to the big warning sign on the front, the signal word.
The signal word is your immediate indicator of acute toxicity. There are four categories you have to know.
Let's hear them.
The most severe is danger poison. That means highly toxic. a taste to a teaspoonful could be lethal. And it legally requires the skull and crossbones symbol.
Wow.
Then there's just danger, which is highly hazardous, maybe causing severe eye or skin damage. Below that is warning, which is moderately toxic. And finally, caution, which indicates low toxicity.
It's a sobering spectrum.
It is. And no matter what, all products must have the statement, keep out of reach of children.
And then there are the registration numbers. They're critical in an emergency.
Yes. The EPA registration number and the establishment number. The registration number identifies the exact product formula. If there's an accident, that's the number you give to poison control or the hospital. They need to know exactly what they're dealing with.
And the section that really dictates your day-to-day actions is the precautionary statements.
This is the safety section, the rubber meets the road part. It details the required personal protective equipment, or PPE. It lists the environmental hazards risks to fish, bees, and so on. And it lists physical or chemical hazards, like if it's flammable. This is also where you find storage and disposal instructions.
And finally, the directions for use. Your legal roadmap.
It lists the legal target pests and sites, the mixing instructions, the application rate, and any special restrictions. Following this section, to the letter, is what keeps you compliant and safe.
Okay, so that's the law. Let's move into the field and put on our detective hats. Before you can even think about what to spray, you have to identify the problem.
And this is the crucial first step. Diagnosis. You have to figure out if the problem is biotic, meaning it's caused by a living thing like an insect or a fungus, or if it's abiotic, caused by a non-living factor.
And treating an abiotic problem with a pesticide is
a total waste of time and money, and it can actually make the real problem worse.
So what are some of those common abiotic culprits we see in California landscapes, the things that mimic pest damage?
Oh, the list is long. The biggest one is water, over or underwatering.
Classic, wilting yellow leaves.
Right. Then you have nutrient issues, either deficiencies or, more often, excesses from over-fertilizing, which can burn the plant.
Yeah.
We also see chemical injury from herbicide drift, mechanical injury.
Your weed trimmer.
The classic weed trimmer girdling. And then there's just temperature extremes, sun scorch, or just planting the wrong place to begin with.
So how do you tell the difference? How do you distinguish an insect attack from, say, salt burn from fertilizer, which can look almost identical?
You look for the pattern. Biotic pests, insects, diseases, they're usually specialists. They'll attack one plant species or maybe a few closely related ones.
Okay.
But if you see damage suddenly appear on your roses and the lawn next to it and the oak tree behind it all at the same time, the problem is almost certainly abiotic. It's something that affected the whole area, like a frost or chemical drift. That non-selective damage is the telltale sign.
Okay, let's shift to the living threats, invertebrates. You say the key often starts with looking at their mouth parts.
It does, because how they eat determines the damage you see. Chewing insects, think beetles, caterpillars, snails, they have mandibles. They tear and slice tissue, so they leave behind obvious holes, notches, or they just strip the leaves entirely.
Missing tissue.
Exactly. The damage is physically missing plant parts. But the sucking pests, they're much more subtle.
The stealth attackers.
They are. Sucking insects like aphids, scales, whiteflies, they have a piercing sucking mouthpart like a tiny straw. They poke into the plant and suck out the sap.
So no holes.
No holes. Instead, you see discoloration, stippling, which is like tiny dots distorted or curled leaves or just general leaf drop. The lack of holes is a major diagnostic clue.
And they leave behind their signature calling card, honeydew.
That sticky, sugary waste. It's excreted by aphids, soft scales, white flies, and mealybugs. And while the honeydew itself doesn't hurt the plant,
it creates a new problem.
It creates a huge new problem.
Mm.
Sooty mold. This black mold grows on the honeydew, and it blocks sunlight, which reduces photosynthesis. Plus, it just looks terrible. It's a major aesthetic issue.
Let's run through the rogues gallery. The most important invertebrates a gardener needs to recognize on site.
Okay, start with aphids. Small, pear-shaped, soft-bodied, usually clustered on new growth. They cause that classic leaf curling. Then you have whiteflies. Tiny, look like little moths, and they fly up in a cloud when you disturb the plant. They cause yellowing.
And scales. Those are the tough ones to spot. They just look like bumps on a twig.
They are tricky because the adults don't move. You have to know the difference between soft scales, which produce a lot of that honeydew and sooty mold, and armored scales, which have a harder covering. And crucially, do not produce honeydew.
No honeydew on armored scales. Got it. And for turf, the biggest enemy is underground.
White grubs, long grubs, they're the C-shaped larvae of beetles, and they just chew through grass roots. The classic sign is spongy turf.
Right.
If the damage is bad enough, you can literally grab the grass and roll it back like a carpet.
Oof. Okay, so understanding the pest's life cycle is also critical. It's not just academic. It dictates when you can effectively treat them.
It's all about timing. You need to know the two types of metamorphosis.
Okay.
There's complete metamorphosis. Egg, larva, pupa, adult. That's for beetles, moths, flies.
Larvas are the main feeding stage.
Right, the destructive stage. Then there's incomplete or gradual metamorphosis.
Yeah.
Egg, nymph, adult. The nymph just looks like a smaller version of the adult. That's your aphids and grasshoppers.
So why does this matter for spraying?
Because your control measures are almost always most effective against the youngest, most vulnerable stage. The newly hatched nymph, or for scales, what we call the crawler stage.
Before it builds its armor.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A mature scale with its waxy armor is incredibly hard to kill with a contact spray. So you can see the adult causing the problem, but your timing for the application has to target when its babies are going to be hatching and moving around.
That requires really close monitoring.
It does. Okay, let's quickly cover weeds and diseases.
Mm-hmm.
For weeds, it starts with classification.
Three types.
Three major groups. You have broadleaf weeds, like dandelions, with net-like veins. You have grass weeds, like crabgrass, with narrow leaves and round stems. And you have sedges.
Sedges have edges.
That's the mnemonic. They have a distinctive triangular stem. And you have to know if they're annuals or perennials.
Because that determines how hard they are to kill.
Completely.
Yeah.
Annual weeds live 1 year. Their easiest to manage is seedlings. Perennials live for years, and they're a nightmare because they have robust underground structures. Rhizomes, bulbs, stolons.
So if you just cut the top off,
it comes right back, sometimes stronger. You have to kill or remove that entire underground system.
And for plant diseases, is the answer always a fungicide?
Often not. For many common landscape diseases, especially things like powdery mildew, which you need to recognize, or root and crown diseases like phytophthora, the best control isn't chemical.
It's cultural.
It's cultural. The best prevention is avoiding the environmental conditions that favor the disease in the first place, like overwatering and poor drainage.
Which brings us perfectly to the next segment, the strategic playbook, integrated pest management, IPM.
The operating manual. This is a strategic combination of methods for safe, long-term control. It's all about reducing your reliance on chemicals.
And it's not just a buzzword. It's a requirement in California. The source lays out five key components, right?
Five sequential steps. One, prevention through good cultural practices. Two, regular monitoring. Three, pest and symptom identification, the detective work. Four, setting action thresholds, so you only treat when necessary. And five, integrating the most appropriate management methods, safest first.
The source says that first step, cultural controls, is the single most important component.
It absolutely is.
Right.
A stressed plant is a pest magnet. Good cultural care starts before you even plant, with host plant resistance.
Choosing the right variety.
Yes. Choose plants that are known to be tolerant or resistant to common pests. If you're planting a crepe myrtle, pick a variety that resists powdery mildew. That's IPM in action right there.
And water and fertilizer. We touched on this, but it's so fundamental.
Water management is key. The best time to irrigate is early morning.
Why is that?
Because the foliage gets wet, but then the sun comes up and dries it off quickly. Many leaf diseases need several hours of continuous wetness on the leaf to infect it. So quick drying prevents disease.
Makes sense. And we know not to over-fertilize.
Right. Too much nitrogen gives you that soft, succulent new growth that aphids and mites just love. For lawns, the rule is about four times a year, but never, ever exceed 1 pound of actual nitrogen per 1,000 square feet per application.
Okay, what about mowing and pruning? Daily tasks that have huge IPM implications.
For mowing, the rule is simple, but so often broken. Never remove more than 1/3 of the leaf blade at a time.
Don't scalp it.
Don't scalp it. It shocks the grass and makes it vulnerable. Also, use sharp blades. And clean your mower deck when you move from a weedy lawn to a clean one.
And pruning. I've seen some truly terrible pruning jobs.
Oh, improper pruning is a gateway for pests and decay. You never, ever top a tree. It creates these huge, ugly wounds. For big limbs, you use the three-cut method to prevent tearing the bark. And your final cut should be just outside the branch collar, which is where the tree's natural healing tissue is.
Let's move to mechanical and physical controls. What's the number one physical tool for weed control?
Mulches, by far. They work primarily by blocking sunlight that weed seeds need to germinate.
And depth matters.
Depth is everything. For coarse mulch like wood chips, you need about 4 inches. For finer mulch, maybe 2. But you have to remove the established perennial weeds first.
And there's a critical warning about mulch placement.
Yes. Keep mulch away from the base, the crown of the plant. Piling it up against the trunk traps moisture and creates a perfect environment for crown rot diseases. Give the crown some space to breathe.
And what about the weed trimmer again? The silent killer.
We have to mention it again because it's so common. That string can easily girdle a young tree, stripping the bark all the way around, which will kill it. You have to use plastic or metal shields around thin-barked trees.
All right, what about traps for something like gophers?
The key to gopher trapping is using traps in pairs in the main tunnel, facing opposite directions. That way you get them no matter which way they're coming from. And then you have to cover the opening to block all light.
So they don't get suspicious.
Exactly.
Okay, now for the unsung heroes of IPM, biological controls. Nature's own pest control service.
These are the predators, parasites, and pathogens that are out there working for you for free, keeping most pests in check. And a good maintenance gardener needs to know them by sight.
So who are the key players on our team?
For predators, you've got the iconic lady beetles. Both the adults and the larvae eat aphids. You have green lacewings, whose larvae are called aphid lions. And syrphid flies, whose larvae are little green maggots that are voracious aphid predators.
And then there are the parasites or parasitoids.
These are usually tiny wasps. They lay an egg inside the pest, and the larva eats the host from the inside out.
And they leave behind a very specific clue.
They do. In an aphid colony, you'll see what are called aphid mummies. They're these hardened, bronze-colored, crusty aphid shells, often with a little round exit hole.
Where the new wasp emerged.
Exactly. If you see mummies, that is a sign of success. Do not spray that colony. Nature is doing your job for you.
This brings up the biggest mistake you can make with chemical applications.
Destroying your workforce. The single most important thing you could do to protect these natural enemies is to avoid broad-spectrum insecticides. Things like pyrethroids. They kill everything, the good bugs and the bad bugs.
And that can lead to secondary pest outbreaks.
It often does. You kill the aphids, but you also kill all the predators of spider mites. A week later, you don't have an aphid problem, but you have a massive spider mite explosion.
So the strategy is always to choose a more targeted, selective material first.
Always. Use things like insecticidal soaps, oils, or BPARs, and control the ants. Ants will literally farm and protect pests like aphids in exchange for their honeydew. Get rid of the ants and you let the good bugs get back to work.
All right, so we've tried everything else. The action threshold has been crossed and we have to apply a chemical. The moment you open that bottle, you enter a new world of risk and liability.
That's right. And you need to understand the classifications. We have insecticides, herbicides, fungicides, but the more tactical classification is about selectivity.
Broad spectrum versus selective.
Broad spectrum kills a wide variety. Generally bad for IPM. Selective targets a narrow group. A great example is a broadleaf herbicide for lawns. It kills the dandelions, but leaves the grass unharmed.
Let's talk more about herbicides. We have pre-emergent and post-emergent.
Pre-emergent herbicides are applied before weeds germinate. They form a barrier. Post-emergents are applied to weeds that are already actively growing.
And for post-emergents, there are two ways they work.
Yes, contact and systemic. Contact herbicides just kill the green parts they touch. They're fast, but they might not kill the root of a perennial.
They'll just grow back.
Right. A systemic or translocated herbicide is absorbed by the plant and moved all the way down to the roots. It's slower, but it's much better for killing those tough perennial weeds for good.
And insecticides have a similar distinction. How does a contact insecticide differ from a systemic one in terms of how you have to apply it?
With a contact insecticide, you need absolute complete coverage. The spray has to physically touch the pest. If you miss a spot, the bugs in that spot survive. With a systemic, the chemical is absorbed by the plant and moves through its vascular system. The plant itself becomes toxic.
Yeah.
So the bug gets a dose just by feeding on the plant, which means your coverage of the actual insects doesn't have to be perfect.
Now for the off-site threat, how do pesticides leave the target area?
Two main ways for a landscape applicator: drift and water movement.
Let's start with drift.
Drift is the movement of spray droplets through the air, away from your target. It's made worse by wind, high temperatures, and low humidity. And it is flat out illegal to spray if the wind is causing substantial drift.
And you can reduce drift by
using nozzles that produce larger, heavier droplets.
And then there's water movement, a huge issue in California.
Huge. This happens in two ways. Runoff is when water from rain or irrigation carries pesticide residue across the surface into storm drains. Leaching is when it moves down through the soil toward groundwater.
And the rule is?
Never ever dump leftover pesticides or even the rinse water from your tank down a drain or sewer. It is illegal, period.
We've mentioned phytotoxicity, plant injury a few times. What are the common causes?
It's almost always operator error. Applying at too high a rate, spraying a sensitive plant, or applying during bad conditions, like the middle of a hot, sunny day.
Okay, let's pivot now entirely to human safety. The four routes of exposure. This is a critical exam topic.
It is. The four routes are dermal through the skin, oral by mouth, inhalation into the lungs, and ocular through the eyes.
And for pesticide workers, which one is the most common?
By far, the dermal route. Skin contact is the most frequent route of exposure, and certain areas of the body absorb chemicals much faster than others.
So when is that risk of exposure at its highest?
During high concentration tasks, so mixing and loading the concentrates, during the application itself, and when re-entering a treated area before the spray has dried.
So PPE, personal protective equipment, not optional.
Not optional. And the specific requirements, gloves, eye protection, coveralls, respirator, are found in the precautionary statement section of the label. The employer has to provide it and make sure you use it.
But California has its own stricter rules, right?
Yes, and this is vital. California regulations require you to wear eye protection and chemical-resistant gloves, always, when you are mixing or using handheld equipment. Even if the federal label doesn't say so, the strictest rule always applies.
And what about cleaning your clothes after a day of spraying?
It's non-negotiable. You have to launder your work clothes separately from the family laundry, in hot water with detergent, and you should wear gloves when you're loading the washing machine. Then shower, wash your hair, get all the residue off at the end of the day.
Okay, worst case scenario, emergencies. There's been an exposure. What's the protocol?
First, stop work immediately. Remove the contaminated clothing, wash the affected skin with soap and plenty of water, and get professional medical help. Call 911.
And bring the label.
Always bring the label or the safety data sheet, the SDS. The medical team needs to know exactly what they are treating.
What about a spill? A bottle breaks in the truck bed.
Treat it as an emergency. Clear the area, contain the leak with something absorbent like cat litter, and the number one priority is to keep it out of storm drains. Then, wearing full PPE, you clean it up and put all the contaminated material into a sealable container for disposal as hazardous waste.
The legal liability for a misapplication seems terrifyingly absolute.
It is absolute. The applicator is always liable for any injury to plants, people, animals, or property caused by the pesticides they apply. A misapplication is any use that's inconsistent with the label.
So if I accidentally spray a client's vegetable garden with something not approved for food crops, what do I have to do?
You have to act immediately. You must notify the property owner and you must notify the county agricultural commissioner. Reporting the incident promptly is mandatory. It shows you're a responsible professional.
Okay, let's get into the mechanics, the tools of the trade. What is the one piece of equipment advice that should be written in stone for every maintenance gardener?
The crucial separation rule. You must have separate application equipment tanks, hoses, nozzles for herbicide use only. Because even tiny, invisible amounts of herbicide residue left in a sprayer can damage or kill desirable ornamental plants the next time you use that same sprayer for, say, a fungicide.
So, a blue sprayer for herbicides, a green one for everything else? Simple insurance.
The cheapest insurance you can buy.
Okay, what's the most common equipment we'll see?
Compressed air or backpack sprayers. They're the workhorses for maintenance gardeners. And you just have to remember to shake them occasionally if you're using a formulation like a wettable powder that can settle out.
What about those sprayers that attach to a garden hose?
Hose end sprayers. They come with a major public safety requirement. They must have an anti-siphoning device or a vacuum breaker.
To prevent backflow?
To prevent the chemical mixture from being sucked back into the public water supply if the water pressure drops. That would be a catastrophe.
Looking at the parts of a sprayer, what's the most critical piece for application quality?
The nozzle. The tank and pump get the liquid there, but the nozzle determines everything else. The flow rate, the spray pattern, and most importantly, the droplet size, which controls drift.
And you have to take care of them. What's the rule for cleaning a clogged nozzle?
Two big rules. First, never use a metal object, like a paperclip. It will damage the precision-drilled orifice and ruin your calibration. Use a soft brush or a wooden toothpick.
And the second rule.
And this is a huge safety rule. Never, ever blow on a nozzle with your mouth. The risk of ingesting concentrated pesticide residue is just too high.
Let's talk about baits. For snails or rodents, how do we use them safely?
Baits should always be applied inside bait stations or with special applicators to protect non-targets like pets and kids. And for an IPM choice, the source notes that iron phosphate snail baits are much safer for pets than the older metaldehyde baits.
Good to know. Okay, back to mixing, our highest risk scenario. What's the fundamental safety posture?
Always measure and pour liquid pesticides below eye level. It's a simple thing that dramatically reduces the risk of splashing concentrate into your face. And remember the California rule. Gloves and eye protection are always required for mixing.
And empty containers.
You must triple rinse them immediately when they're empty. You add a little water, shake it up, and pour that rinse water, the rinsate, into your spray tank to be used in the application.
In there.
Then you puncture the container so it can't be reused and dispose of it properly.
Okay, finally, the bedrock of a legal and effective application. Calibration. Why is this so important?
Calibration is how you ensure you're applying the correct amount of pesticide to a given area. Skipping it is just negligent. It's critical for four reasons.
What are they?
Legal compliance, so you don't exceed the label rate. Pest control efficacy, so you don't apply too little and fail. Human health protection, to avoid illegal residues. And just plain efficiency, so you don't waste expensive product.
How often should you calibrate?
Regularly, at the start of the season for sure. But also, anytime you change your walking speed, change the product you're using, or even just change a nozzle. Worn-out nozzles change your flow rate, so you have to recalibrate.
So to wrap up this section, a successful application is a combination of everything.
It's the whole system. The right equipment and PPE, the correct rate from the label, the right site, proper coverage, and maybe most importantly, the correct timing for the pest's most vulnerable life stage.
We have covered a tremendous amount of ground today, a truly deep and comprehensive dive, translating that technical UCIPM guide into the practical knowledge you need. And this was designed to be your essential guide, a resource from Within Range Coaching, really dedicated to helping California agribusinesses stay safe and compliant.
We did. We uncovered that stringent QAC Category Q environment, stressing that your work must be incidental and that you're limited to general use materials. We detailed the need for 2 years of records and those critical zero application monthly reports.
And we really hammered home that the label is the ultimate law, from understanding the signal words danger poison down to caution, to always following the PPE requirements. We went deep into diagnosis, you know, chewing holes versus sucking distortion and spotting those abiotic problems.
And we laid out that whole IPM playbook.
Yeah.
Prevention first with cultural controls like proper pruning and early morning watering. We talked about mechanical controls like mulching and the absolute need for a separate herbicide sprayer.
And finally, the absolute safety standards. Measure below eye level, triple rinse your containers, wear your state mandated PPE, and know that your liability is absolute. If you make a mistake, you have to report it to the CAC.
You really now have the critical knowledge framework for the exam and for safe practice in the field. But let's leave you with one final provocative thought to chew on, building on that idea of biological controls.
Mm-hmm.
The source material says over and over that good cultural practices are primary, and that nature's own workforce, those beneficial insects, keeps most pests below damaging levels for free. We talked about how broad-spectrum chemicals just blow up that whole system.
Right, leading to those secondary outbreaks.
You know, consider this. In your routine monitoring, you are trained and paid to look for problems. You're hunting for the scale, the grub, the leaf spot.
You're looking for damage.
You're looking for damage. But how often do you actively look for signs of success? How often are you hunting for the aphid mummy with a little exit hole, or the lacewing larva on patrol, or a lady beetle laying eggs? Shifting your perspective from just searching for damage to actively searching for success is the highest level of IPM. So what shifts in your own monitoring habits can you make to maximize your reliance on nature's team? Find the success, protect the success, and you'll find compliance is easier and your chemical bills are a whole lot lower.
Until next time, keep digging deeper.